Evening, everybody. Welcome. We are number three. Is this number three of Russ? So we finished the intro, right? We're into Russ. Does everyone have some kind of copy or Russ that we only need the first few verses, but we're going to actually be looking inside at the Pesukim a bit. So it'd be nice if you had something there. That'd be great. I am recording this. Okie dokie. So first of all, I would like to... We've only got an hour, so I'm really going to keep it nice and tight and punchy because we've got to end on time because there's another shiur right after this, this super speaker who you're, of course, all invited to. And I'd like to discuss a Medrash Rabbah that I saw on the first Pasuk of Rus. Now, the first Pasuk of Rus, if I can get it here, which is 1-1, is Vayhi b'mei shofet ha-shoftim, right? And it happened in the days when the judges judged, and we talked about the fact that that means... They were judging their judges. There was a famine in the land. And a man went from Bethlehem, Bethlehem, to, in Judah, which is Judea, to sojourn in the fields of Moab. She was Naomi. That's the first pasuk. Before we even get into the actual words of that, there is a Medrash Rabbah in the Hakdoma, in the introduction to Rus. And it says something which I just felt as if I've got to share with you. It says like this. So this is Medrash Rus Rabbah, chapter 1, verse 1. And it says like this. It starts talking about Joshua. It's like, what? Yeshua? Yeah. Are we in Rus? Yes, we are. Why are you telling us about Yeshua? I don't know. Let's see what it says. It says that Joshua was buried on a mountain called Ga'ash. Gimel Ayin Shin. Ga'ash. Now, Ga'ash is generally the word for an earthquake. That's like Mount Earthquake. And when Joshua died, they buried him on Mount Earthquake. Now, what's going on? What does this mean? Says the Medrash, this is in response to the Jews' incredibly lackadaisical eulogy of Yeshua. They didn't give him a hesped. They just buried him. With very little pomp and circumstance, they were like, oh, Joshua's dead, we'll bury him. This was the number two leader after Moses. He should have had full state burial, like the best burial you could. They just buried him. Whatever, he's dead, he's just some man that died. What does it mean, earthquake? The Medrash on Mishle, which is Proverbs, says that laziness leads to destruction. And the Medrash there says, what is the laziness? It's the laziness of the way the Jews buried Joshua led to the destruction of our famine. God was very upset with it. Now, do you think he was upset because they didn't give him a proper burial? Is that really what it's about? It's the reason why they didn't. So it says there in the Pesichta Teruah, in the opening of Rus, in the Medrash, that in this overview, in the period of Judges, it was described by our sages as one of spiritual decline, which we mentioned in the intro two sessions ago, right? And the decline was a process that developed over time. And this passage identifies one of the central features, which is deduced from the account of Joshua's passing, his burial, and how Klal Yisrael dealt with him. If you look at the book of Joshua 24, and verses 29 through 30, it records his death in very sparse terms. Joshua, the great leader of the Jewish people, Moshe's disciple, died and was buried. And that was it. No sign or hint of any national mourning or any grief whatsoever. They just buried him. No eulogies, nothing. So the Medrash sees signs of spiritual decline already in Yeshua and says Mount Ga'ash is not the name of a place. There's no mountain in Israel called Ga'ash. There is no such mountain. It's rather a description of the state of the people at the time. It was like an earthquake. They were frenetically engaged in work and were remiss in according Yehoshua his final honor. Their failure to mourn or eulogize him was not an oversight. It was an outcome of the fact that their minds and their energies were focused solely on themselves. on the portions of land they received and on their own material pursuits and vocations. Now, remember in Vayikra, Yutes, Chof Gimel, which is Leviticus 19:23, there is a mitzvah to settle the land. There's a mitzvah. It says, when you shall come to the land, you shall plant any fruit tree. So there's a mitzvah to go to Eretz Yisrael, and there's a mitzvah to get involved agriculturally in its development. There's a mitzvah. And that involvement must be in a manner that keeps it within the proportions of Torah mitzvahs. So you have a mitzvah to cultivate Eretz Yisrael. Every material pursuit must have boundaries. And when you venture beyond the boundary, beyond the shear, you do so at the peril of your spiritual well-being. And that applies to material pursuits that are mitzvahs, such as working for a living, learning, and even one's focus on settling the land of Eretz Yisrael. The people in the generation of Yeshua, in the generation of Joshua, clung to the land and saw their focus as the inheritance of the land to the extent that they had no room in their hearts or in their minds to act kindly towards their leader, Joshua. And the leader who had led them into the land, conquered it and apportioned it to them, was now secondary to my busy day getting involved in the mitzvah of Eretz Yisrael. That's not what the Torah wants. You've got to do it. But you've got to do it in a balanced way. So the question here, which we're going to bow into Rus, why Elimelech left, is what is a chesed? A chesed, an act of loving kindness, is the expansion of one's own self to include others. One of the things in Judaism is we have to don lekaf schus. We have to judge other people favorably. It's a very, very difficult thing to do. One of the ways that we're told to do that is pretend you yourself have done that thing that you see wrong in others and go through what excuses you would give as to why you did that. Someone does you wrong or they don't say something to you and you're like, oh, chotzef, they're so cheeky, they're so rude, look at the way they behave. Imagine you had done that, all the excuses you would give. I didn't see you, I didn't realise, I wasn't looking. Give those excuses to the other person. Just like you would excuse yourself from that bad behavior, excuse them. Chesed means move out of your own sphere and give what you would want for yourself to other people. If you want other people to be clothed and full, their tummies should be full, help other people be clothed and make sure their tummies are full. If you wouldn't want to be alone, go visit someone who's lonely. That's called chesed. It's expanding what you would want to other people outside of yourself. One who is completely wrapped up in himself and his own pursuits finds it impossible to have the proper sensitivity to others, to ensure their well-being and to care for them. That's why the Nachlas Yosef comments in his introduction to Rus, one can spend his entire life frenzied with activity and caught up in himself as if he's asleep to what God really demands of him. And that's what it means they didn't bury Yeshua properly. He's buried on Mount Earthquake. There's no Mount Earthquake. It's an earthquake of Judaism that people got so busy with cultivating the land, they couldn't realize the God of Lador had died, so they just chucked him in a pit. Something's going wrong. Now we're going to go into the text. With that in mind, let's go into the text. Yeah, is that okay? So we're now in a, if anyone's got a text, if you don't worry about it. I'll read it out for you. It's not a problem, but it's nice to see it just so you can see where I'm at. So it says, Vayhi b'mei shofei teshvotim. And it happened in the days when the judges judged. Vayhi ra'ov be'eretz v'yelech ish. That there was a famine in the land and a man went out. Why does it say Vayhi twice? And it happened? What do I need that? Well, first of all, we're going to need to look at the word vayhi, especially the words vayhi b'mei, and it happened in those days. The Medrash on Eicha, which is another Megillah we've got to do, which is a really rough, that's a tough Megillah. Eicha is really, really intense, and it's very grueling because it's talking about sad things. On chapter 131, says where, it says an interesting thing. It says, her adversaries have become the head. It laments that the people who hate Israel have become powerful people. Like Rome has become very powerful in the world, and they're a great enemy of the Jews. And that's on verse 1:5 in Lamentations. So in the Medrash 1:31 on verse 1:5. It says, during the siege of Jerusalem, in the time of the Second Temple, rebels deliberately set fire to the storehouses of grain and food. When the news reached Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, he exclaimed, "Vai, vai," which is where the Jewish term oivei comes from. Oivei comes from this concept of vai. Vai, as if to say, what a disaster, vai. When the rebels heard Rabbi Yochanan's remark, they were Jewish rebels, they were extremely angry and wanted to kill Rabbi Yochanan because they felt he was now against their decision to burn the storehouses. So let's kill him. He's a political adversary. So the learned sage heard about this and he defended himself. And he said that he didn't say vai, but rather ve. And you misheard. Ve, which is an expression which signifies great joy. He went on to explain that now the storehouses have been destroyed, the people had no choice but to fight their enemies with all their might until their enemies, the Romans, were annihilated. This desperate show of force would not have come about unless these rebels had burnt down all the food houses. So he says, I'm on your team. I'm actually happy you did that. And it's a great joy because now people will have to fight the Romans. So we learn that vai is used to express sadness, while ve is used to express joy. This concept is said, if you look in the Medrash to Esther, it says in Kings 1, chapter 1, verse 1, and the King David, and the King David, Vaha. The first two letters are vav and then hay, which is ve, which denotes joy. And that's because King David brought great joy to the land of Eretz Israel. So we see vav hay is very good. On the other hand, in Kings 1, chapter 16, 28, it says over there, and Achav reigned. And when it says, and Achav reigned, the first letters are vav yud, which is always an expression of sadness. Vav yud is bad, vav hay is good. What have we got here? Vav yud. Vav yud is bad news. It is bad news, people. So we see that this is doubly bad news. So where it says vayhi b'mei and then vayhi again, there's two things going wrong here. It's doubly bad. It's telling you that a whole situation is essentially dire. One physically, one spiritually and socially. Okay? Is everyone okay with that so far? This is really important. Corruption leads to famine stroke plagues. Plagues are the outcome of human corruption. It's a divine retribution for human behavior. As I gave the COVID-19 shiur about Shabbos Rosh Chodesh, which is online, it's on Study Day Torah in the Gem site, is all the sources for this COVID-19 come out of the last chapter of Isaiah. And it even tells you where it's going to come from. Street markets where people eat reptiles and rodents. That's where things come from. I.e. God is unhappy with the way things are happening. And that is a particularly detestable thing. He'll make plagues come from there. Corruption always leads to famine or plague. There was a famine in the land. It says that. It happened in the times of Judges. There was a famine in the land. That's what the first verse says. Either they deserved to be judged for one reason or another, or they refused to accept the jurisdiction of the courts and even prevented the courts from carrying out their judgments. That's what it means when the judge is judged. Whenever the judges try to hand down a verdict, the people would condemn the judges to that very sentence. So if the judge says you owe them £100, they're told the judge, you have to pay £100. They judge the judges. So whatever the judges would say, you have to go to jail for a year, they'd take the judge and chuck him in jail for a year. Which of course meant the judges wouldn't judge. There were no judges. It's interesting. I saw Yalkut Shimoni on Rus 59698. That's 59698. And it says a man from Israel was found serving an idol, which is forbidden. So they took him to court and the judge sentenced him. But when he did that, the man beat up the judge in court. In the Medrash 1:1, we read, woe to that generation who judged their judges, and woe to those generations who judges need to be judged. So it's going to mean that once you have a social breakdown of corruption, a famine, a physical famine or some kind of plague is bound to ensue. And that's how we open up Rus. That's why we see the necessity for saying Vayihi twice in the same pasuk. Because there were two reasons for despair. One led to the other. So what does it mean, Vayihi bimei shofet shahashafotim? Oy vay, vay, vuvav yud. The judges were being judged and being locked up and beaten up. That's terrible, social and injustice. Vayihi ra'av ba'aretz. Next words, oy vay, there's a famine in the land. That's going to be as a direct result of shofet shafotim. You judge the judges, I guarantee to you, I will not allow society to carry on like that. It's a very interesting thing that you see during COVID-19. There's been a lot of news articles of acts of random loving kindness, of people helping out other people that don't have food, don't have anyone to visit them, that people have to, the government has to be kind by furloughing and giving grants. Suddenly, kindness has to be the order of the day. Notice how that happened because of COVID. The next thing that the pasuk talks about is it says that a man, an ish, which is an extremely high level designation of a person, mi beis lechem Yehuda, from a place called beis lechem Yehuda, legur b'shtad Moav, he traveled to the shtay, to the fields of Moab, and he left the land of Eretz Yisrael. Right there, the Medrash and the Alshich start commenting, is it even permitted to leave the land of Eretz Yisrael? Why is no mention of Elimelech's wife and children made here at the beginning? And why are their names supplied only in the second verse? In addition, I'd like to say the word he is completely superfluous here. Just say a man in Israel. Why do you say have to say he? And a man went forth to Bethlehem and he, his wife and his two sons. What's going on? So let's have a look. There's a Gemara in Bava Basra, 91a. And it says the rabbis teach that one must not leave the land of Eretz Yisrael unless the price of two se'ah worth of product has reached one se'ah. Right? Has reached one seller. So one seller is a value of money. So if inflation has got so high that something where you would usually pay for something has become so ridiculously expensive, you can't afford to live. Unless that happens, you can't leave the land of Eretz Yisrael. So it's index linked to inflation. If it becomes overinflated, you have a reason to leave the land of Eretz Yisrael. Rabbi Shimon says on this point, I've heard this only applies in a case where there's nothing available in the markets. But if produce can be found, even if the price stands at one se'ah for a seller, which is much more expensive, it's still forbidden to leave. You've got to cling to the land of Eretz Yisrael. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, he said, Elimelech, machloin and kilyoin in Rus, quoted in the Gemara, quoting this verse in Rus, were the greatest people in their generation. Why were they punished for leaving the land of Eretz Yisrael? He says, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, because they left the land of Yehuda to go elsewhere. Rabbi Chiya Bar Ovin said, in the name of Rabbi Yeshua, Chos v'sholem, even had they been able to find only bran, they would not have left. They were punished because they ought to have begged for mercy on behalf of the people of the generation, and they neglected to pray. Notice Noah, Noach, in the time of the Teva, he was chided by God by not davening for the rest of the generation. Noach did not daven for his wayward generation and just kept making the boat for himself, as it were. When Avraham heard that God was going to destroy Sodom and Amorah, which was full of the worst drug dealers and thugs and mafiosis in the world, the first thing he did was intercede for mercy for them. He said, perhaps you could spare them. Maybe there's righteous people that live there. So you see that Avraham did pray for his generation, even though they were very unworthy. Noach and Elimelech didn't, and that was the problem. But do they really deserve to die? We see that Elimelech and his sons were very righteous people. They were the leaders of the generation, and Ish is a very, very high designation of a person in the Torah. And they were condemned to die now, it seems from the Gemara, either because they left the land of Eretz Israel, or because they forgot to beg for mercy, or didn't beg for mercy for the people of their generation. So always remember, when you're davening now, in COVID-19 situations, daven that the world should be safe, that people of the generation should be safe. But Be'ez Hashem, you, your family, your friends, your community, but all Jews and all people, you've got to daven for your door as well. Don't forget to daven for your generation. Noach and Elimelech were chided for davening for not davening for their generation. And Elimelech might have died because of it. It's one of the two reasons. Now, he was on a very high level and he didn't daven. But that does mean that it's very important that you daven for the people in your generation. It seems a bit absurd that the death sentence should be handed down for those reasons alone. Doesn't the town, in fact, the Gemara in Bava Kamma 60b says that there's a sanction to leave the land of Eretz Yisrael in a famine. It says, if there's a famine in the city, scatter your feet, run. So there's a good reason to leave the land of Eretz Yisrael. Even if they were guilty of leaving when they shouldn't have, the sentence of death seems very harsh. The only explanation is found in Yevamos, page 121b. And it says there that God is particularly punctilious, very stringent with the righteous, even towards a hair's breadth. The greater an individual is, the greater his scrutiny can be in the eyes of the law, the greater God calls him to task. A man of Elimelech's stature should have known, one, he's to daven for the people of his generation, Jew and Gentile alike, and two, he should cling to the land of Eretz Yisrael very, very much, even though he'd have good reason to leave, because people will look to him to see what people should do. They'll say, the God Lador has run away, which is what they did say. They said, oy vey, who's going to look after us now? The God Lador has run away. That's incredibly true. Now, I do not mean, Chas v'Shalom, to portray Elimelech in a bad light. I'm not doing that. And I don't want Elimelech to say to me, oh, you think I'm bad? Have you checked out Mordechai Goodman? Chas v'Shalom, I've got no bones against Elimelech. But now we're going to see Elimelech in a very different light. The intention is to portray the piety of Elimelech and why he was judged so severely by God for doing what he did. Gomorrah Tarnis 11a says that a righteous man must not cohabit with his wife during times of drought or famine. There's a Tosfos. That if there's a famine or a drought, a righteous man should separate from his wife. They should live separately, man and wife, but they shouldn't have any marital relations. Now, the Tosfos says, actually, that only is for a chosid, a pious individual. We don't mean a person with a fluffy hat. This predates the Hasidic movement of 350 years ago. We mean an individual who's beyond righteous. They're particularly pious and devout. Such an individual, it's right that they separate from their wives during a time of global danger. This law is derived from a verse in Genesis, in Bereishis, chapter 40, verse 41:50. It says, and to Joseph were born two sons before the years of famine came about. Joseph married a woman called Osnas, who was his half-sister, and they had children called Ephraim and Manasseh. And it says those kids were born before the famine struck the land of Egypt. He said there's going to be 7 years of plenty, followed by 7 years of famine. And the Torah goes on record to say those kids were born to him before the famine. So we learn out that only before the famine did Yosef carry on intimate relations with his wife, but not during the years of famine. The Gemara Sanhedrin, 108b, says from Noah, we learn out from Noach, again with the ark, and you shall come into the ark, you and your sons, your wife and your daughter-in-laws with you. That's Bereishis 6:18, Genesis 6:18. Noach and his sons were forbidden to cohabit with their wives while the floodwaters were on the earth. Thus God deliberately mentioned the men apart from the women. You, your sons, your wife with her daughters. No, the men and the women were separate. They had separate cabins on the cruise ship Noah. You know what I mean? Cruise ship Teva had different cabins for men and women. But when they left the ark, relations were permitted. In Genesis, in Bereshit 8:16, it says, leave the ark, you and your wife, your sons and your daughters-in-law. It's recoupling man with his wife. So it can be noted that Noah is mentioned with his wife, his sons with their wives, normal life should resume. Our verse is demonstrating the behavior of Elimelech during the famine. If you look carefully, it says a man alone, and a man went from Beis Lechem Yehuda to sojourn in the fields of Moab. He, his wife, and his two sons. What does that teach us? He didn't travel with his wife because it was a time of famine. Once he arrived in Moab, scripture places him together with his wife, he and his wife. Only while they were in Beis Lechem were they separated, because that's where the famine was. When they got to Moab, there was no famine, so he cohabited with his wife. So we see from there that he was a very pious man. He was as pious as Noach, as pious as these great tzaddikim. Yosef, that separated from his wife, very high-level tzaddikim, know not to be with their wives during famine. Elimelech was on that level. He left alone. His wife and kids will go later. Because he's not touching his wife. It's a famine. He's one of those. That doesn't mean all of Israel did that. All of Israel did not behave on that level. Only people of very high stature. So learn that Elimelech was of a very high level. And he took upon himself not to cohabit with his wife. Because he knew he was holding by that. That's what the verse is telling us. It's introducing you to the level of piety by telling you who he's going with and who he isn't going with. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that amazing what you learn? What his traveling arrangements are tells us his darga spiritually. That's amazing. Something you might miss when just reading through that intro. That's very interesting. He says, what did he do there? He went to sojourn in the fields of Moab. Those words indicate that his guilt was greater than it would have been had he have chosen to go to any other place but Moab. Do you know what that's like? That's like saying, and the rabbi left the land of Jerusalem to go and dwell in Auschwitz. There's no other place you could figure out to set up camp? Auschwitz? You want to go to Auschwitz? Yeah, there's very fertile land there now. There's food available there. There's a nice town there. If everyone's been to Auschwitz, it's a town. It's a town. There's people that live there. Did you know in Auschwitz now, in the actual complex of the concentration camp, there is a hut that sells DVDs and postcards. There's a gift shop. There's a gift shop in Auschwitz. Can you believe that? So he went there now. We would say, for goodness sake, of all places to go to, you're obviously crazy. Like, or he went to go and dwell in, I don't know, in some like very dangerous Muslim land. Why did he? The Torah excluded male Moabites from joining the Jewish people because they had refused to supply the wandering Israelites with bread and water on their way to Israel. And that's in Devarim, Deuteronomy 23, 4 through 5. Now, the truth is, the Israelites didn't need bread and water. They had plenty of man and plenty of water from Beer Miriam, the well of Miriam. They were completely sorted for food. But Ammon and Moab showed a great lack of courtesy and respect, for they ought to have remembered just how well Avraham had treated their ancestor Lot. Avraham went to war for Lot, and he saved Lot's life. And if it wasn't for Avraham saving Lot's life, they wouldn't have even been born incestuously to his daughters. Goodness sake, the sons of Avraham are coming round. We at least ought to pop out and give them some food. It was thus considered very embarrassing and degrading for the Jews to seek out bread in all places of Moab. The Moabites would have realized that Elimelech's only intention in going there was to beg for bread. Next, is everyone okay with this so far? Next, if you look at the next verse. So the man's name was Elimelech. His wife's name was Naomi. And his two sons were named Machloin and Chilion. Ephratites. They're from the tribe of Ephraim, of Beis Lechem in Yehuda. And they came to the field of Moab, where they remained. Very interesting. And then it says, Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. Rabboisai, my masters, do I need to know who he's married to? You just told me, not two verses ago. It says, he, his wife, and his sons. And why are you telling me he died? What's going on? And then the very next thing, and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Rus, and they lived there about 10 years. Can you see that? Can you see that? Is everyone with me? This is key. Whenever we see juxtaposition in the Torah, there's always very deep lessons learnt. I just gave a shiur about the juxtaposition of Miriam with the spies. We see the most unbelievable link with Miriam and the spies. There's always juxtaposition. Always juxtaposition. What's the juxtaposition here? Elimelech died. The son, and what does it mean? Naomi's husband. Then the boys married Orpah and Rus. It's like this. There's a pasuk in Tehillim in Psalms 133:1. And it says, how good and pleasant is it when brothers dwell together? This is especially so when they are in the presence of their illustrious father or a saintly teacher, and they live together under the auspices of such a teacher, because they'll be ashamed to sin as if their father is always standing in front of them. Notice, Joseph was encountered by Zuleika, who was the wife of Potiphar, who was trying to seduce him. She was the third most beautiful woman who had ever been created. The most beautiful woman was Isha, who was later called Chava, Eve, by her husband. She was so beautiful that if you put Sarah next to her, Sarah would have looked like a monkey. Sarah was the next most beautiful woman in the world. Next most beautiful that ever lived. And if you put her next to Zuleika, Zuleika would have looked like a monkey. But Zuleika, Asia's Potiphar, the wife of Potiphar, who tried to tempt Yosef, was the third most beautiful woman who ever existed. And she was tempting Yosef. And Yosef got a visage of his father, Yaakov, who came to him saying, Yosef, if you sin with this woman, your name is going to be emitted from the breastplate of the Kohen Gadol. You can't lose her. What kept him on the straight and narrow? His father's presence mentally. If brothers dwell together in front of a saintly father, they're going to keep on the straight and narrow. Yosef was able to not succumb. He defended himself and he didn't sin. Famously becoming Yehoshua HaTzadik, the righteous Joseph. A notable example of this is a man who lived in awe of his mentor was King David. King David wanted to marry Pharaoh's daughter, something which his son Solomon later did, which led to the worst thing in Solomon's career. And David wanted to marry her very, very much. But his Rebbe was a man called Shimi ben Gera. And he was alive. And purely out of respect for his Rebbe, he felt as if he shouldn't marry her. It's interesting. I got married in South Africa. And I didn't get married in Israel. I had to go to South Africa because my wife is South African. And one of my Rebbes told me, it's very interesting. I've got to tell you, this is a personal thing. He told me, you're going to South Africa and you're all alone. You don't have any of your friends with you. You're getting married without any of your Rebbes. Nobody's coming. Basically, only, you know, almost nobody's going to be with you. He said to me, don't let the photographer take any pictures of you which you would be ashamed to show me afterwards. What an interesting thing to say to me. He said, I can't be with you. I'm not coming to South Africa. Okay? I wish you well. I wish you Mazel Tov. But whatever the pictures are that they ask you to take out there, whatever they are, pretend I'm standing with you and you'd be ashamed. And he says, as long as you got that, everything will be kosher. He said, imagine I'm with you. That's a very big thing. Imagine Shimi ben Gera was with you. David Melech wouldn't marry Pharaoh's daughter. Elimelech was the leader of the entire generation. And he was the man, it says, in Rus Rabbah, that was most suitable to be anointed king. If anyone's going to be king, it's going to be Elimelech. There is little doubt that his sons would have been ashamed to have married Moabite Gentile girls in the face of their saintly father. But now that he's dead and their mother, only Naomi, is left with them, they had very few misgivings about marrying out of Judaism. Though their mother was still alive, they didn't fear her. In general, children fear their fathers more than their mothers. And that's the reason that the Torah places the mother before the father in the commandment to fear your parents. Each man should fear his mother and his father. It says in Vayikra, Yud Tes Gimel. That's Leviticus 19:3. God says, fear the mother first, because it's not natural. The Gemara Kiddushin 31a says it is not as natural to fear the mother as the father. So the Torah gives the mother precedence, implying that both the mother and the father should be equally respected. What does it mean, the husband of Naomi? It says, Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died. Well, I couldn't figure that out by looking three psukim back. I know who he is. I know who she is. Why are you telling me? What? You got to understand what's being said here. What an amazing thing to learn about our own stature and our own lives. Why was Elimelech now given the title in Pasuk Gimel as Elimelech Ish Naomi, the husband of Naomi, not an Ish in his own right? Elimelech had sinned by leaving the land of Israel. And he did not become a free thinker and abandon Judaism. He kept all the biblical precepts, he kept all the mitzvahs, and he certainly would not have gone as far to marry a Moabite woman. Had he have done so, his sons would have had not any qualms about doing likewise. He was exclusively the husband of Naomi, and he was faithful to her. He kept his Jewish way of life with her, and he kept the mitzvahs in their marriage and in how they kept a home. You'd walk into their home, it would be a Torah home when you walked into their home. While he lived, his sons were influenced by his saintliness, and he refrained from marrying Gentile girls. Once he was dead, however, we find they married Moabite wives, and Naomi made no attempt to stop them, even though by appealing to their consciences, she may have succeeded them in convincing them from doing though, and she was punished for that later. But what's important here is the next point. One sin leads to another, says Pirkei Avos 4:2. Chazal made a fence around the Torah saying Gentile bread is osser for you to eat. You shouldn't have paspalta. Don't eat Gentile bread. Why? Because eventually you'll end up flirting and being in commonplace with the townswomen folk. So Gemara in Shabbos 17b, eventually a slippery slope will happen, you end up intermarrying. Elimelech went to go and get some bread, to eat bread. And what happened? His sons married out. He went to eat Gentile bread and his sons married out. Even though he baked his own bread, he could not keep his sons from intermarriage. The phrase, the husband of Naomi, is explained as follows. You may think that Elimelech didn't die merely for one sin. Obviously, many sins had accumulated and tainted his soul, and they were the cause of his early death. The sin of leaving Eretz Yisrael for Moab could not have been grave enough to warrant such a severe sentence, right? Shmuel the prophet, who wrote Rus, tells us otherwise. Elimelech was the husband of Naomi. Do not assume that his death was due to many sins. And there was, you know, he had lots of problems. The only reason he died was because he left Eretz Yisrael, being such a great man. The Gemara in Sanhedrin 22b says, the death of a man is felt by none but his wife, because it is written, Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died. The Talmud was bothered by the extra words, husband of Naomi, because we already know that the husband of Naomi was Elimelech. What does this mean? The sin of a man can bring him so low that he's dragged into the dust. Elimelech was the greatest leader in Judaism. He was the Godol Hador. He was the greatest teacher and everything. He was accorded the title of Moses, that of Ish. The man Moses in Exodus 1:3 was called the man, Moses, Ish, which indicates in his generation he was like Moshe. Now, however, he's just Ish Naomi. He's just Naomi's husband. What's going on? At first, he was a respected leader of the community. Had he died in his homeland, and this links back to Joshua, that we said at the beginning, that Joshua was born without any pomp and circumstance. They just buried him. Who cares, right? They didn't care about their leadership. Had he, Elimelech, have died in Eretz Israel, they give him a state funeral. It's on the front pages of the Hamadia. Tens of thousands of people would have attended the Leviah. They'd have been mourning with public eulogies, all downloadable on Zoom. That's what happened. It would have been announced that a great man in Israel has passed. And now that he's in Moab, and now that he's left Eretz Israel, and now that his wife and children have settled there many years, the husband of a man called Naomi died. He was no longer famous. He was no longer important. He was no longer influential. His death affected only his wife and not the people of Israel. Elimelech's wife and sons did not go unpunished. She remained with her two sons. They were refugees, lucky to have escaped death for the moment. The Gemara in Yuma 87a says, "Happy are the righteous in whose merit their children benefit." It says there that Aaron had sons who deserved to die like Dothan and Aviram, because it's written who remained, but their father's merit stood by them. Because their father was so great, his merit covered them. So that is conveying, this concept of the Medrash is conveying how elevated Elimelech and his standing was in the community and how drastically diminished it was when he left and became some Jew living, I don't know, in Auschwitz. The people in Auschwitz didn't care about him. Originally, his wife and children were subordinate to him. But once he settled in Moab, he was considered of secondary importance. You know what he was? He was Naomi's husband. Naomi became the most important matriarch of the house. And the man she lived with was a man called Elimelech. They were not called his wife and his children, rather he was just the husband of Naomi. We're informed not that his wife remained, but that she remained with her two sons. Because the children were subordinate to her rather than him. Which means she had now more influence than he did, and she didn't use it to say don't marry out. That's why no mention is now made of his sons. It seems that she now held influence over them and could have said something, but didn't. And that's why it says, Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. Not his sons. Can you see that? It's very interesting. I'm going off a bit. Come with me. It'll be fun. When Yisroi came to join the people of Israel, He was encountered by the clouds of glory. And nobody, if you were looking for the ancient Israelites in the desert, you wouldn't be able to see them because they were completely covered in thick, like fog-like clouds. And anyone who tried to walk into them, it was like a sheet of steel. You couldn't go through them. Anyone who chucked a stone or an arrow, you couldn't get in. They were completely protected. One arrow only ever pierced the clouds of glory. And that was Yisro's arrow, which he shot in with a note on it for Moses, like to Moses, center of people of Israel, from dad. You know what I mean? So he rolled it up, put it on the arrow, and he shot the arrow into the clouds of glory. And it landed miraculously outside of Moses' tent. So Moses saw an arrow, which of course never happened, land in the ground. And he took the note off of it, and it says, "Your father-in-law Yisroi is waiting for your presence outside the clouds of glory, because I can't get in. Says, come and meet, give honor to your father-in-law. Says, if you don't want to come for me, at least come to meet your wife, my daughter, who is with me. And if you don't want to come for them, come for her children who are with her." That's interesting. Now, Tzipira, we know, was Moshe's wife, who he had divorced earlier because he didn't know how long he's going to be as Mashiach, and she stayed with her father. And now he's coming bringing his wife back because Tzipira is Moshe's wife. Why didn't he call Tzipora's children Moshe's children? He said they're her children, not yours. Answer is, he had no input. He'd been busy being the Messiah of that generation and being the famous Moses, which is a very busy job, and he had lots to do, which is very, very good. But because of that, he had no sway, influence, or educational input over his children. You sometimes hear of that with great gedolim. Great gedolim, sometimes you hear that they were so busy that when their children are asked about, you know, what it was like growing up, they said, well, I hardly ever saw him. In such a case, that child is considered the child of the mother. Moshe Rabbeinu's children were essentially educated by Tzipora alone. So Yisro calls them her children. They're not yours. You may be the biological father, but you've had no input. You haven't been a father to them. So they're called her children. It's interesting. Someone who adopts a child is considered their parent in heaven, not the biological parent. We learn that in several places in the Torah. Yecheved, the mother of Moshe, was never called the mother of Moses. Because basically she gave him up a few months after, basically as soon as he was weaned, 3 months after he was born, you know, just a few months after he was born. The woman who raised him was Basia, who was the adopted daughter of Pharaoh. And that was the mother, because she raised him. Whoever raises you is the person who's considered your parent. And to them it's Kibbud Av, or Kibbud Ein. So that's why Yisro said, it's her kids, not yours. Notice here, it says a very important thing for life, this. We see here the Torah, Shmuel HaNavi, who wrote Rus, is saying, they're Naomi's kids. They're Naomi's kids. Because Elimelech left, and he abandoned what his job was, the kids naturally listened now to her, not to him. He's fallen in status. They're her kids. He's a husband to Naomi. He's a spouse. That's his role now. So we see that this was a very deleterious move for him. Is everyone comfortable with that data so far? Any questions? Yeah, oh, Clive Moss Barkley wants to ask a question. Clive, let's hear it. Yeah. Oh. Try again. You want to try again? No? You good? Adrian, do you have your hand up? Is that your hand up? No? Yeah? Anyone want to ask? No? Good to carry on? I'm just going to carry on because I'm getting a bit like, I don't know what people want. All these little hands coming up. They could be a question hand or a just carry on hand. What's going on next?
Hello.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, Clive, you're back.
Yeah, sorry about that.
Yeah, go for it. Absolutely.
Okay. The clouds of glory. How did a Moloch, how was a Moloch able to attack the stragglers when they were supposed to be surrounded by the cloud of glory?
What a brilliant question! And the answer is already in your question. It's the word stragglers. Those individuals who were impure because they became afflicted by Tsaras or Zov. They were stragglers in the fact they were spiritual stragglers. They were not allowed in the camp until they were purified. Those people, men and women, who were found by Moloch outside the cloud, they were captured. That's what it means, stragglers. And that's who was vulnerable outside of God's divine protection.
Number two.
Yep.
Osnath.
Yes.
Who married Yosef. You said half-sister, but I learned his niece.
You're quite right. I made a mistake. That's right. That's correct. What happened was that Shechem abducted Dina. Shechem abducted Dina, and Dina was Yosef's half sister. And Dina became pregnant. Through the, she was accosted. And the child that she had was called Osnas. Therefore, That was his half-niece. That's correct. I said half-sister, and that's wrong. I'm sorry. Yes, that's incorrect. It was his half-niece. See, I stand correct. Thank you very much for bringing that. I do apologise.
She had an armlet.
An amulet, that's right. Written.
And she threw it into his chariot when he was made viceroy.
That's right.
And he was going round in the chariot, and she threw the amulet in there. It said, this is the granddaughter of Avram.
Of Yaakov.
Of Yaakov, yep.
That's right. Now, he was white. It's interesting. All the girls had heard that Joseph was the most beautiful man in the world. And they all went up to have a good look at him. And they were whistling and shining shiny jewellery objects at him and chucking them at him. So he would look at what was hitting him. So Ephshah, just for a moment, they would catch a glimpse of his beautiful, handsome appearance. And he kept incredibly modest. He kept his head down, looking at the floor of the chariot the entire time. Osna saw that, and she chucked this amulet down, and it landed at his feet in the chariot. He picked it up. He didn't see her, and he went to Pharaoh, and he said, whoever the owner of this amulet, I want to marry her. It turned out he knew her anyway, because she was owned by Potiphar. And she was one of the slave girls that he was also enslaved to. And Pharaoh immediately gave him Osnas as a wife because he said, I think a person of a political stature who's going to become an important person in the country, it's right he should be married because people look up to someone who's got a stable relationship more than a single man. So he was only too happy to marry him off, and therefore he married Osnas and had Ephraim and Manasseh, so it was all within the same family. That's correct. Is everything okay with that? Are we good to go for another bit? Is there any other questions? Okay. Ellie, are you want to ask a question?
Yes, please.
Yes, okay, Ellie.
It's on what you said before about Vayhi.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't the case, the suggestion that Vayhi connotes something negative, isn't that like only a Havamina, only an original assumption in Gemara elsewhere, I think, Megillah?
Well, as we said, I brought the Gemaras at the beginning, quoting why definitely Vayhi, Vav Yud at the beginning, is word worse than Vav Hay. So we definitely saw that wherever we see Vayhi be made, it's always a sign of... It's same with Esther. So we see it over and over again, that it's always a sign that something is going wrong. And I don't think we could get better proof from how we're understanding Shefer to Shefotim, and then a plague of famine. So this is one of the places that it's not a Hava Amina, it's a scriptural source. It's one of the places we learn it out from to say that in Rus and in Esther, where it says Vayhi b'may, bad things were happening. The question is if Vayhi is bad, how come we say Vayhi era Vayhi voke yom hashishi? And it was evening, it was morning. What's bad about Shabbos? What's bad about that? Vayhi is bad, right? Indeed, the Chazal answer, it was bad because God had to hide his light from the world because he didn't want Rishoyim to gather it. They didn't want to, he doesn't want them to benefit from it. So he has to hide his countenance in the world, only making it available for tzaddikim and for those who merit Olam Haba. So to a certain extent, this world, the creation of the world, is a Vayhi. It is sad in the fact that God's great light and joy that he wants to give people has to be restrained and constrained within evil. So because, unfortunately, there are naughty people that really don't deserve being close to Hashem. So it pains him, as it were. It's sad that he can't give what he wants immediately. He's going to have a stage where people are going to have to earn that. And that comes with excessive risk sometimes to some people. But that's the nature of the concept of free will. And that's why it says, Vayhi era Vayhi voker. It always says Vayhi. And it was because there's a negativity there. Because God is constantly withholding himself. He's got to. He's got to allow humans to have free will. Do you feel comfortable with that answer?
Yeah.
Is there anyone else that wants to ask anything? No? Is everyone okay with that? Now, because, Baruch Hashem, I'm very glad that you asked this question. I'm very happy to do that. The next psukim are now talking about the marriage of Orpah and Rus. And the two of them, it says, Machlon and Kilion died. And the woman was thus bereft of... The woman, just the woman, was... Naomi, obviously, was bereft of her two children and of her husband. Notice so many things to learn out from the order in way this is discussed. There's so much to discuss. But boy, so I want to dig into this. There's so much to learn about familial development, society, family, assimilation, intermarriage, the progeny, the legacy that people leave. But unfortunately, we're hitting a mark. If I start it, I'm going to cut into the next rabbi's great shiur, as it's coming up 9 o'clock. So I'd like to start, but I feel as if I'm taking you away. We've got to stop on the hour, right? So you've only got 2 minutes or 1 minute. So I'll just start with one thing, and then we have to call it quick. Okay, a quick... Don't leave yet! But I don't want to drag it, because I know there are people waiting, and I don't want to take away from other people. It's a very interesting thing. It says, the name of his sons were Machloin and Chilioin. And we see that Machloin was the older. And he should have married first. But he didn't feel it was right to take a Moabitess as a wife. But once his younger brother got married earlier than him to a non-Jewish woman, and he broke the mold, as it were, Machloin duly followed suit. But the guilt mainly lay with his brother, and he was the one who initiated the deed. That's why the Gemara in Sanhedrin 102b contrasts the sins of Achav and Yerovam in this way. The light, i.e. the minor transgressions of Achav, that Achav did, were equal to the gravest transgressions of Yerovam. The worst things Yerovam did weren't as bad as only the lightest things Achav did. But scripture says that Yerovam was a bigger Rosha than Achav. Yerovam was, he was not in absolute terms as bad as Achav, who was the absolute worst. But Yerovam was told he's worse. Why? Because he started it. He was the first one to tell people you don't need to go to the Beis HaMikdash for Yontif. He was the one that said you can worship a golden calf if you want. Achav went as far to say there won't be a ditch anywhere in Israel where there won't be an idol to worship. All the more so in the case, since Machloin did no wrong and Kilioin, he merely followed an example. So his sin is considered many times less serious than that of Kilioin. The name of the second was Rus. The meaning is, don't consider Machloin's sin to be so grave. You must not forget that Rus was his wife. She married Machloin only after his brother Kilioin had broken with tradition. So because Machloin followed his example, that's unfortunate. But that introduction is going to help us very much understand why so much good came the way of Machloin and Rus, while so much bad happened to his brother and Orpah. His brother was completely destroyed, had no descendants, he was wiped off of history forever, and his wife came to the most terrible end. And yet, Machloin, who married Rus, he's going to end up, you know, his wife is going to end up seeding King David. And he's going to come back as Rus's son, as a Gilgal. As we're going to learn, that's the whole point of Yibam. That's the whole point of Yibam, is that the husband comes back as a reincarnation of the son of that wife. So all this good came to Machloin, not Kilioin. Why? Because he wasn't the first to break with tradition. Don't be the first to walk out on the tradition of your fathers. Even if you're making a mistake, at least let's be able to say, I'm only following someone else who did it first. Because don't be the one who really is the fence breaker. It's a thank you very, very much for attending tonight. I really appreciate it. But Ezra Hashem will be able to start going into Psukim 5, 6, 7 and 8 and see why it is that their settlement in the land of Moab was so bad. They should have left earlier, and they showed that they were really happy to stay in Chutz La'aretz, which is bad news. And Be'ez